Elissa Walker Campbell to deliver sports the way you want it. Big names, bold interviews. Beyond the X's and O's. Think big. The Big E Sports Show.
Elissa Walker Campbell, we are back this weekend on the Big E Sports Show. And before we get underway with our second interview, we want to direct you to our radio website. That is eradiosports.com. And I have to share with all of you, it has been a while since we've had the opportunity to tee it up and talk about the game of golf. The 2012 Masters, of course, is less than 1 week away. And it is always so wonderful to celebrate the game, the sport we love, by inviting in James Dotson, who has just released a brand new, a fascinating book, and I want to encourage all of you to go out there and get a copy of it. It is titled American Triumvirate, Sam Snead, Byron Nelson, Ben Hogan, and the Modern Age of Golf. Welcome in, James. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, tell us about your brand new book, because I know you had a lot of fun chronicling these golfing legends and sharing, you know, the impact that they had with the game and how they changed it.
Well, that's really true. I was very fortunate to help Arnold Palmer write his memoirs, and then the Hogan people, Ben Hogan's estate, called and asked me, they offered to sort of let me have access to Ben's kind of never before opened up private files, and his friends and family who'd never really spoken publicly about Ben, who was really probably the most certainly the most guarded and mythologized golfer and maybe athlete in American history. So I did that, and it was really quite wonderful. I had a blast, and it was a bestseller. And the funny part about that was I had done over 120 interviews for that book, and I had a lot of the old stars that were contemporaries of Snead and Hogan and Nelson, and I couldn't get it all into the Hogan book. So that came out. That was the golf book of the year in 2005. And I was very close with Sam Snead. I knew him. I wrote a book called Final Rounds that 15 years ago that he was in. And I knew Byron Nelson. And ironically, I didn't know Hogan. He had passed away before I would have had a chance to meet him. And long story short, I felt sort of obliged to sort of honor these two guys because I've always kind of felt Snead and Byron never got the credit they were due for really shaping the modern game. So that's what I set out to do, tell this story about these three remarkable men, all born, by the way, on three consecutive days of the week, a Sunday, a Monday, and Tuesday, exactly 3 months apart in 1912, the year the Titanic sank, the year Fenway Park opened, the year most major cities in America got electric lights for the first time, the year General Electric introduced a newfangled thing called an electric dishwasher. So it was a real change point in American history, a real sea change time in America. And they came out of the poorest neighborhoods. One was from the mountains of the Blue Ridge. The other two were from good old Fort Worth. And they really made an impact on golf that is being felt today. When you watch a PGA Tour event today, you see things that Byron Nelson and Ben Hogan and Sam Snead innovated years ago.
Well, you know, as golfing fans, we are just so spoiled today. I mean, just all the modern technology and the game has really evolved and changed over time, James. But what were some of the challenges that Sam Snead, Byron Nelson, Ben Hogan, that they faced during their time playing golf?
Start with this. In 1930, Bobby Jones retired from golf. He won what was called the Grand Slam. He won the major championships of Britain and America, and he decided he had had enough. He was 30 years old. He was tired of competition. He basically retired from the game and went back to law school. When there were two other players that were probably the stars of the game, Walter Hagen, who was a real showman, and Gene Saracen, who was a young, cocksure, strutting character who won the U.S. Open twice. But the irony was that they were really tired of kind of traveling, and they were not playing as much, and after Jones left the game, there was left a void. And, of course, in 1929, the stock market crashed. Golf was a rich man's game in America prior to that time. Half the clubs in America closed. Half the clubs in America shut down, shut their doors, plowed up their fields. And these three were country boys. Or Byron was a sunny Christian lad who was born in Waxahachie and survived a typhoid fever at age 10 and gave his life to the Lord, believed it was a sort of a miracle that he survived. Ben Hogan was a man whose father shot himself in front of him. His father ran a stable, and his father was his hero. And when the stable closed down in Little Dublin, where there's a fabulous new Hogan Museum. Let me make a plug for them. Just opened. A fantastic place.
Wow.
Ben's mother moved him to the bright lights of Fort Worth, found a job as a seamstress. And Ben literally went to work on the platforms of the grand old Texas and Pacific Railroad depot, selling papers all night. Often found us, woke up in the morning on the bench with his aviator cap pulled over his eyes. And then you had, of course, Sam Snead was grew up in the most rural vertical county of Virginia, in the Blue Ridge Mountains. So they were all children of poverty in a way, as most Americans were, but America was in the grip of the Depression for most of their young lives, or growing up in the 20s, and then when they came of age as golfers in 32, 33, there really wasn't much. There was very little of a tour. It was a roustabout, a vagabond game, and they all set forth to sort of try to make a mark, to make a few bucks. It took Hogan three times. He tried and failed to make it on the tour three times. Went bank, basically lost his, went bust all three times. Never won. Nelson kind of caught fire first, won a few tournaments, and was. With his sunny, happy disposition really endeared him to people, and people helped him. And then Sam Snead was a colorful character. You know, and that's really the fascinating thing about this book. You could not have had three more different men between whose personalities and life experiences were very different, and each of them had a huge impact on the game. Well, we'll start with Ben. Ben was the... start with the oldest, Byron. Byron, as I say, was this sunny, cheerful man who grew up to become the great ambassador of the game. He left the game in 1945. He was 46. He retired 45. He won 18 tournaments in 1 year, if you can fathom that. 11 in a row at one point. He retired the next year at age 34, right where Tiger Woods was last year. He had just grown kind of weary and wanted to own his own ranch. Ben Hogan, who didn't win until 1940, won his first tournament at Pinehurst in 1940, and then became a kind of a whirlwind. He taught himself. He was probably the least talented of the three, but he had the hardest work ethic. He became very slavish. He developed routines of practice on the practice tee that are commonplace today, and he really became the kind of poster boy for the underdog in America. So during the Depression and during World War II, when Hogan started to finally win in 40 and 41 and 42, he became a figure that people watched because the feeling was, here's a guy who really didn't have a lot of gifts, but he had a work ethic that caused him to become the greatest player probably ever. And lastly, there was Snead, who was colorful and funny. I contend that Sam Snead in 1936, 37, when he broke through and won, was really the reason the PGA Tour survived. It was struggling. It was really just a loose alliance of clubs, tournaments that were stretched across the country, and it was about to basically fold up in 36 and 37. The players were fighting among themselves. There wasn't really much money to be won. Along comes Sam Snead, this colorful, funny, folksy character from the mountains of Virginia who always had a kind of clever quip, and he was great-looking. He knew how to dress. He put golf back on the front pages of the sports pages of America for the first time since Bobby Jones had left the game. And that really was kind of the touchstone, the beginning of the rebirth or the birth of the modern PGA Tour.
We are having a wonderful conversation with James Dodson. He is an award-winning writer. He's got a brand new book that is out. And James, tell all of our listeners where they can go and get a copy of it.
Well, I'm sure it's at your Barnes & Nobles and Amazon's and all your bookstores. I'm very, very pleased. It's gotten wonderful reviews because people who love the game, I think, have always heard about these mythic figures. They're kind of the grandfathers of the tour, and they are our American triumvirate, is what I call them. And it's around all the bookstores.
Of course, it is titled American Triumvirate, and I am curious. You know, we were talking about Byron Nelson and that he did retire at such a young age. I mean, 34 years old after just 14 years playing pro. Did he regret that?
No, I don't think he did. Byron, who, as I say, I knew, and his wife Peggy was just—they were just great. His second wife Peggy, Byron, I think, was driven by different. Each had a different kind of motivation. Ben Hogan's. Let's start with him. Ben Hogan was driven by this kind of internal. I hate to say demon, but a kind of a desire to be somebody because he was a runt. And as I say, I talked to a lot of psychologists for the host's first Hogan biography about what the effects of having your father shoot himself in front of you would do to you. And Hogan's life struggles were all about becoming an insider. He wanted to be somebody, and he became the ultimate, in many ways, the ultimate golfer of success. Certainly the most mythic figure that ever played the game, besides Bobby Jones. Byron was, as I say, this sunny, cheerful kid who really did believe his principles of the Church of Christ. And I think he wanted to seriously become a man who had an influence on other lives. He spent most of his career, incidentally, as a club professional who played tournaments. The other two kind of had club associations, so Byron took his work very seriously. He worked at Inverness and several other, Reading and several wonderful clubs, and really loved the interaction with the members. He loved teaching the game. He became a great teacher, a great mentor. People like Tom Watson and Tom Kite, a whole host of young Texas stars, Corey Pavin and Ben Crenshaw and others really became his kind of pupils. He's very generous with his time. He's also kind of the father of their modern golf swing. Golf shafts changed from wooden to steel in about 1935, 36 as these guys were starting to win or to play. And Byron really developed a modern swing, and I go into some detail talking about how he did that. Incidentally, the testing machine the USGA uses is called Iron Byron, and that's for a good reason. Byron was probably the straightest shot maker who ever lived. And as I say, Snead, lastly, had probably the most athletic golf swing anybody had ever seen. He was really, people talk about Tiger Woods being an athlete. Sam Snead was a five-letter athlete in high school, and he could have chosen to play many sports, but golf was his first choice, and he had the most amazing natural swing ever. So I think Byron's case, he didn't miss tournament golf. He did what he wanted to do. He won, over 50 tournaments, and by his count, close to 75 tournaments. The tour didn't give him as many as they should have. And he was a guy who, as I say, loved the social interaction of the game and the values of the game, and that really became his forte. So he really didn't miss it too much. He still played in Masters all the way up through the early 60s, the mid-60s, so that was quite a he believed in perpetuating the game. That was really his strength.
Well, congratulations on the book, James. You certainly provide some fascinating details on three very talented men that grew up, as you had said, in some very tough times during the Depression and left quite a legacy that we all appreciate and love so much, especially right here in Fort Worth, Texas. So, James, thanks so much for stopping by. Again, the title of the book is American Triumvirate, Sam Snead, Byron Nelson, Ben Hogan, and the Modern Age of Golf. And as James had said, you can go anywhere online and at Barnes & Noble and pick up a copy of that. Hopefully, we'll see you here in Fort Worth at the Colonial. Okay, James?
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
You bet. We're going to step aside. Much more straight ahead here in just a moment. Did you know that Complete Production Services is one of North America's leading oilfield service providers, offering field support solutions, equipment, and well production optimization and enhancement to some of the largest oil and gas companies? Complete Production is fully committed to developing solutions for your operating environment and can handle any oilfield demands, well servicing, and rentals. Most importantly, they are committed to superior customer service and also focus on safety and the environment. Service, expertise, innovation. Complete Production Services. Join us online at CompleteProductionServices.com.
The Big E Sports Show with host Elissa Walker-Campbell just got bigger. Featuring former defensive star and three-time national champion at Nebraska and NFL player Jason Peter. Jason Peter. Under the helmet. With Jason Peter on the Big E Sports Show with host Elissa Walker-Campbell.
The good times continue to roll this weekend on the Big E Sports Show as we get set for our final segment, our Under the Helmet segment with Jason Peter. Jason, it's great to have you back. We've got just a myriad of things to hit on. I got the good news, the press release. You guys are getting ready for your third straight year for your celebrity golf tournament.
Yeah, we're excited about it. It will be in September this year. For the past few years, we've been somewhere in October, but we try to line it up with a Husker football Saturday, and you want to make it a good game as well when they play the Sisters of the Blind early in the year. Sometimes it's not that big of a draw for people to come into town, but this year we kind of either had to go earlier at the end of September, or the next home game was not until late October. So it's September 27th and 28th, and the Saturday, that Saturday, is the 29th, and that is the University of Wisconsin who is coming into town. So it's, in a lot of ways, Wisconsin, with Barry Alvarez as the athletic director, he kind of molded that program after being here at Nebraska, because Barry Alvarez was a linebacker here at Nebraska, and nothing but great things to say about the university if you ever hear Barry Alvarez speak. And he's been very vocal about forming something similar out in Madison as to what we had here or have here in Lincoln. Now, if you watched the game last year, it would look like we're the kind of the little brother looking up at the older brother with the whooping that they put on us on national television. But, yeah, in terms of the golf tournament, we're excited. It's going to be a exciting weekend around here.
Well, it's always such an incredible event. Who can we anticipate? I mean, who are the headliners? I'm hoping Larry the Cable Guy will be back for a second return.
Yeah, that's where all the proceeds go, is to Larry's Get Her Done Foundation, and he'll be there. And there'll be a long list of Husker all-stars and legends. I mean, Neil Smith is a guy who's been coming for years, and Grant Wistrom, I leave out a lot of guys, but pretty much a who's who in Nebraska football history, plus a bunch of others. And I think they all are a lot of guys now, even the players, want in on this golf tournament because they all want a chance to bid on that Saturday Night Live package.
Oh, yes.
That seems to be the marquee piece of the auction, where people just, I mean, you witnessed it. It's pretty amazing.
My husband's hand slipped up a couple of times.
I'm hoping that this year you're going to go a little deeper into the bidding war.
Okay, Jason Peter is with us this weekend on the Big E Sports Show, and now we are quickly approaching into the month of April, so I'm assuming the Cornhuskers, they're underway with their spring practice now, correct?
Yeah, and it's set up a little different now, where they have spring break right in the middle of practice, so it's got to be difficult in a lot of ways, I think, because as a coach, you're constantly installing new stuff in the game plan, and then out of nowhere, you got to say goodbye to the kids for 10, 12, 13 days, however long it is, and then you come back and you finish up for another couple weeks. But they have the spring game on April 14th, and it should be another close to sellout crowd.
Now, I am curious, Jason, since we were just a moment ago talking about the game of golf, of course, Tiger Woods, he ended his drought with a win at Bay Hill last weekend, and we've got the Masters approaching next week. What did you think about that? I mean, a little bit of a rebirth there, a renaissance, and perhaps he's back in stride.
Not a big deal. The guy's won there seven times now already. It's his backyard. No. What I think is, number one, it's comical, because I've never heard so many people now come out of the woodworks and say, "I told you so. I knew Tiger was going to be back, baby." And for the last 2 years, all I've heard from people was how he's finished. And all of these young guns, they don't care about what he did in the past. And the run is over. And now everybody is back on that Tiger bandwagon. But I'll tell you, he played well, and when a guy goes out and shoots in the high 60s and he's doing his interview after and he says, "I just didn't hit the ball well," I think that says something. And whether or not he can kind of use this momentum and take it right into the Masters, that remains to be seen. I think it certainly is not going to hurt his confidence having a victory under his belt, and it was a good field, So it's not like he beat up on a bunch of hacks. I mean, you had some quality golfers in that field, and he played well, I mean, all around, hitting the ball, putting. I mean, obviously, like he said, he'd tell you that he could do a lot of things better, and I think great athletes always say that no matter how well their performance was. But I think, you know, the cameras are probably going to be on him for all 4 days in a couple weeks.
What's incredible is just how he shot up the golf rankings. I mean, that was his first victory in 30 months. He moved to number 6 in the world rankings. And as you had said, Jason, I mean, it really boosted his confidence. And the game of golf, it is so incredibly mental. And he certainly will need that going to the Masters, a place where he has always played well.
Yeah, and it doesn't, it just changes the world of golf. When Tiger is doing well now, it becomes a sport that is front page news. And it was like that. I mean, Tiger kind of really changed, I think, the way that people looked at golf. He changed the type of people that were standing there on the course. And for a while there, I'm sure the network executives were thinking, gosh, could this guy just win a tournament here so we can kind of start building our ratings back up again? And I know they're all breathing a sigh of relief with Tiger having this victory, and now he's got people excited again, and people are, you know, he's got that effect where it's similar to Notre Dame, where I think people either love him or they hate him. And especially with the things that have gone on in his personal life. But I also think that you've been able to see how much of a second chance country or nation that America is, because I think a lot of people have said that's in the past. And until he shows me that he's not a changed man, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and believe that he's living life the right way, and that's what's great about our country.
Well, you're right, Jason, and it certainly shows his value to the sport. And I want to ask you this. I mean, it's not a softball question, but, I mean, is he bigger than the game of golf? Because you talk about just how, you know, the ratings, they skyrocket when he's on.
Yeah, I don't know if you could say or even put that in, if you could plug in another athlete in a different sport into that question. I think Tiger is a guy that he changes the way people follow golf. And I don't know who else you could say that. I mean, you look at the big stars in the NFL, you know, Tom Brady and Peyton Manning, and I don't think they have the same input or the same effect. I think people are going to watch NFL football every Sunday, no matter if Tom Brady's the quarterback or if Jamarcus Russell is coming out of the indoor league to start again on an NFL team. I mean, it's just people, it's the NFL, and if there's a reason why it's one of the biggest businesses in our country and the biggest sport in our country. But
Tim Tebow certainly seems to be larger than life, though, right now, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, how about that? But he got a taste of that New York media right away. I was laughing, telling my wife that the next day after he did that press conference, the New York media had already started with his fashion selections, and that $895 Hugo Boss off-the-rack suit should have stayed on the rack, and he should have went custom, and he shouldn't have worn square-toed slip-on loafers. And I'm thinking, golly, they'll let anybody cover football if they're writing stories about this, because ultimately we're getting away from the game here. And that's sad, too, because lots of times guys' values as a whole in terms of what they bring to a team, well, it's, you know, is he marketable? Is he this? Is he that? And I'm thinking, you've got one of the most, if not the most marketable player ever in the NFL in Tim Tebow, and you are nitpicking here with the type of shoes that he wore and that his legs are too big to wear flat front pants. And I mean, it's just, it was comical.
But the thing of it is, though, Jason, is that he seems so resilient that it doesn't bother him. It doesn't penetrate him.
It doesn't. And that's, I watched it. And I watched the press conference, and I'm thinking to myself, how can you not like this kid? Like, you don't have to love him. But I mean, to hate him, I mean, what does he do that makes you hate him? I mean, every question he's answering with a smile and as polite as could be. And think about some of the bugs and the guys that have been up there answering questions before who they look like you're twisting their fingernails off while they're making $5 and $6 million a year, and they can't answer a question in a full sentence. And here you got a guy who's got a smile on his face, realizes he's one of the luckiest guys in the world because he's playing a sport and he's getting paid to do it. He's in his athletic prime, and he loves waking up every day. What's wrong with that? I mean, sure, you can criticize the way he throws a football, or you know, if he can't execute a play on the field, then write a column about that. But you're going to tell me you're going to write a column because you thought his $895 Hugo Boss suit didn't fit him right? I would love to have that $895 Hugo Boss suit off the rack.
Jason Peter with us about 2 more minutes this weekend on the Big E Sports Show. We've got to quickly transition. And, of course, Bill Parcells feels what obligation to help out Sean Payton, that is, with the scandal-ridden New Orleans Saints. What is your thoughts? Weigh in on that.
It's a little odd just because you have a franchise that has been under the same leadership now for a while and won a Super Bowl and been very competitive in the years that Sean Payton has been the head coach. And to me, it's, you know, guys down there, they're used to doing things a certain way. And yeah, Sean Payton kind of started under Bill Parcells, and you get kind of that, well, if I got to trust anybody with my baby, then I'll trust, you know, this guy because he's the guy that I learned from. But Bill Parcells is not Sean Payton. And even though you might have been in the same room and he taught you some X's and O's, I mean, there's going to be some drastic differences. And I think the way that Parcells would coach that team in that year, if he's true to himself. I mean, I don't think Bill Parcells can go into that New Orleans Saints organization and say, I'm going to try to coach this team like Sean Payton. I mean, you're just not letting Bill Parcells be his true self, and in the end, he's not going to be the best coach he can be. So for him to go in there, he's got to be him, and is he going to start, you know, calling the quarterback Drew Brees she? You know, is he going to start referring to these guys as women when he doesn't like the way that they play? I mean, he did that when he was in New England. He's done it in New York. You know, he does things to create, I think, a camaraderie and a cohesiveness within the players when he kind of makes it almost a us versus them between coaches and players. But I don't think you can go in and do that in a franchise that's already got its foundation, and a pretty good foundation, be that.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see how it plays itself out, and we'll definitely let's delve into that next week too, Jason. We are flat out of time, and we certainly appreciate you dropping by. Thanks, Jay.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. We're going to step aside here in just a moment.